Hello, and welcome to part 15 of my podcast, All About Antarctica. I'm Dr. Steve Emsley, and I'm a professor in the Department of Biology and Marine Biology at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, where I've been teaching an undergraduate class titled Antarctic Ecology, Geology, History, and Policy. In this podcast, I've distilled this class down into numerous parts that will cover all these topics about Antarctica. Part 15 presented here is on the Antarctic Treaty. After the International Geophysical Year of 1957 to 1958, Antarctica became a focus of scientific research that continues to this day. In 1958, most of Antarctica was under territorial claims by seven nations, as well as the subantarctic islands. Those nations again were Australia, New Zealand, Britain, Norway, France, Chile, and Argentina. The only overlapping claims were those of Britain, Chile, and Argentina. And in 1947, Chile and Argentina agreed to, quote, a harmonious plan of action for the better scientific knowledge of the Antarctic zone by means of exploration and technical investigations, unquote. That quote is from the book by Paul Berkman, Science into Policy, Global Lessons from Antarctica, published in 2002. However, conflict between Britain and Argentina continued to grow and eventually led to the Falklands War in 1982. In fact, the only shots fired in anger in Antarctica were in 1952, when the British were landing at Hope Bay, at the northern tip of the Antarctic Peninsula, to rebuild their base D, originally built in 1948 but burned down, and where the Argentines were also building a new base today called Esperanza. The Argentines fired a machine gun over the heads of the British when they were landing, but later apologized. No one was hurt, but it reflected the tension developing between these two countries at that time. One possible solution that could have prevented these conflicts was proposed by the U.S. in 1948, when it was offered that Antarctica become an international trust territory, or that all claimant countries renounce their claims and place Antarctica under a United Nations trusteeship. However, only New Zealand agreed to relinquish its claim, so the idea failed. Then the IGY occurred and brought countries together for a common purpose based on scientific research in Antarctica. The first international conference to emphasize science in Antarctica was held in Paris in 1955. Most of the countries that attended this meeting were later to become signatories of the future Antarctic Treaty. It was thought that science, not politics, would finally bring accord to Antarctica and all territorial disputes. So, by 1959, there were seven claimant and five non-claimant nations involved in Antarctic research, and all had participated in the IGY. The non-claimant nations were the U.S., the USSR, Japan, Belgium, and South Africa. Since it was now known that Antarctica held extensive oil, gas, and mineral deposits, the 12 nations began a series of secret meetings in Washington, D.C., at the invitation of President Eisenhower. These meetings were skillfully led by the retired diplomat representing the U.S., Paul C. Daniels, and resulted in formal meetings in October 1959, with the Antarctic Treaty finally signed on 1 December 1959. A date each year celebrated in the U.S. as Antarctica Day. Daniels died in 1986, but there is an ice-buried mountain range named in his honor in Antarctica, the Daniels Range. The treaty recognized claimant nations as consultative, with voting rights on any new amendments or articles added to the treaty, while non-consultative countries who signed the treaty could not vote, but would accede to terms of the treaty. The treaty was ratified by each country within their own governing bodies and went into effect in 1961. The treaty stated at the beginning that, in the interest of all mankind, that Antarctica shall continue forever to be used exclusively for peaceful purposes and shall not become the scene or object of international discord. It allowed for the presence of military from each country, but only for peaceful purposes, such as logistical needs, and stressed scientific cooperation between countries. The treaty does not expire, but can be reviewed and modified with a majority vote of consultative parties. Importantly, it did not dissolve previous claims to Antarctica, but set those claims aside, which was a critical part of the treaty to get claimant nations to sign. The Antarctic Treaty was the first arms control agreement that included a ban on nuclear weapons or weapon testing in Antarctica, thus avoiding future conflicts on the continent. It became the most successful non-nuclear international treaty ever enacted. The treaty had 14 articles that detailed the agreement, including use of Antarctica for peaceful purposes only, freedom of scientific investigation with international cooperation, no weapons testing, especially nuclear, application of the treaty to all areas south of 60 degrees south latitude, freedom to inspect stations by designated observers, how to resolve disputes, if any arise, how to modify and amend the treaty, and the process of ratification. It was and remains a landmark international agreement. How did this treaty come about in a time when the Cold War was creating tensions among different nations, including those that were the first signatories to it? The force behind the treaty was President Dwight D. Eisenhower, the 34th President of the U.S., who in the decade before had been instrumental in winning World War II as Supreme Commander of Operation Overlord, landing troops in Normandy to move across Europe and defeat Nazi Germany. Eisenhower had a unique ability to work with British and French officers and act as a mediator in many situations. After the war, he was quite popular on the international scene, saw the need to bring nations together to avoid conflict, and always kept peace as the final goal in any conflict. After World War II, he saw the Soviet Union as a threat to international peace as the Cold War increased, but it was his popularity and ability to bring nations together that resulted in the Antarctic Treaty. One question remains, though, as to why the U.S. did not make a territorial claim in Antarctica. We certainly had the right to do so, with all the work and exploration Richard Byrd had accomplished at Little America and Marie Byrd Land. To learn more about this, in 2018, I visited the Eisenhower Presidential Library in Abilene, Kansas. This library has all the letters, telegrams, phone records, and other information related to the Antarctic Treaty, and I received permission to sift through these records to better understand how the treaty came to be. I spent 2 days reading and taking notes on these records, and it was exciting to hold in my hands what were once considered top-secret documents, some signed by Eisenhower, as I learned more about the treaty process. It became apparent from this research that the impetus behind the treaty included Eisenhower's concern that the Soviets would expand operations there and make territorial claims. Eisenhower, however, still refused to make a claim for the U.S., despite that we could legitimately claim territory there. Eisenhower believed that making a claim would expand the Cold War to an entirely new continent, plus it would require increasing the military budget to maintain a presence there, something he didn't want to do. In addition, he wanted to avoid conflicts similar to those that were occurring between the British and Argentina that would only add to the divisiveness among claimant nations. By getting claimant and non-claimant nations to agree to the treaty, including the Soviets, it would avoid all these issues and resolve territorial disputes, at least for the time being. The documents I reviewed also indicated that Eisenhower was under pressure to make a claim for the U.S. Several members of Congress had sent him letters pointing out that there were rich mineral and oil resources there, and that we should make a claim to have access to those resources. Even his National Security Council drafted a statement declaring a claim for the U.S., but Eisenhower apparently ignored it. It was very interesting to glean this information from the library documents, and yet, if you look at all the numerous biographies that have been written about Eisenhower, not one of them mentions the Antarctic Treaty, which is arguably his greatest and yet least known achievement in his life. Since the treaty was ratified and went into effect in 1961, numerous amendments have been made to it. The original treaty was very basic and did not include protections for the environment or the wildlife endemic to the continent and surrounding oceans. So, over the years, the treaty nations passed by consensus first the agreed measures of 1964 relating to the conservation of Antarctic flora and fauna, then the Seals Convention of 1972 to protect seals from exploitation on the high seas south of 60 degrees, the Convention for the Conservation of Antarctic Marine Living Resources, or CAMELAR, was signed in 1980 and set forth management standards for sustainable use of fisheries in the Southern Ocean. An amendment for the protection of mineral resources was signed in 1988, but was never ratified. And finally, the Environmental Protocol in 1991 called for the cleanup, control, and removal of wastes and prevention of pollution at research stations and went into effect in 1998. In general, this amendment stated that all activities in Antarctica must be conducted with no adverse effects on the climate, air, water, or species. I personally witnessed many changes at research stations in the 1990s as this protocol was enacted. Today, the treaty still works and maintains Antarctica for peaceful and scientific purposes only, maintaining it as a world park. The data sharing and cooperation among scientists from over 50 nations that have now signed the treaty have been remarkable and have given me the opportunity to work and spend a season at many international stations, including those operated by Poland, Australia, Argentina, Spain, Italy, China, and the UK. The treaty will never expire, and it can be modified at the annual treaty meetings, where delegates from each country discuss any possible amendments to add to the treaty and other issues. Thank you for listening to my podcast, All About Antarctica. I'm Dr. Steve Emsley of the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and I hope you tune in to Part 16, Research Stations and Life in the Cold.